Today is the 9th of March 2010. I'm continuing the interview with Cheryl Cartwright. Our previous and first session was on the 2nd of September 2009. The interview is continuing with me, Barry York. Cheryl, were you able to listen to the previous session at all, and do you have any comments or areas you'd like to elaborate on?
Yes, I did. Thanks, Barry. And it's kind of strange listening to yourself talk about old times, but I think most of what I recall was there. But you did ask a little about systems. And while I was very much a junior in the office, I did have a chance to think a little about some of the systems that I was involved in. There was, in those days, we used to rely a lot on shorthand, those of us who were able to do shorthand, and but also, and again, not computers, so all of the letters had to be typed on typewriters using lots of little whiteout and things like that. One of the systems I do recall with correspondence, while most correspondence major issues was handled by the department and then filtered up through the Prime Minister's office, as is the case now with Prime Ministers and Ministers, quite often the initial response or some of the smaller responses could be done with a personal touch from the Prime Minister. And those were drafted by, I think she would have been called an office manager. Before Cathy Queeley, there was Malcolm Hazel, who eventually did come back and work for John Howard in a similar role. Cathy would draft up brief responses that we had to fill in the gaps, and as the typing pool, provide those personal touch letters from the Prime Minister. So, and I can't recall the details of what they were about, but it was clear that there was a sense that either the person was important or the issue was important to the Prime Minister personally, and so he wanted people to know that he had signed a personal letter in response. Sometimes there was going to be follow-up by the department or another person or by the Prime Minister, depending on the issue. So there was that. The other thing that I did recall was, on occasion, the speeches were drafted from the start, were originated in the Prime Minister's office, whereas usually you work from a draft that had been put together by the bureaucracy. And I do recall once or twice Petro Georgiou, who could come up with a speech off the top of his head, he would have two of us taking it in turns, going in and taking shorthand as he spoke, going out and typing up while the other one was doing the shorthand and alternating for a whole speech. And other times, I might have already mentioned, speeches were often worked on late into the night, and we often went up to the lodge, and there was a little alcove there up some stairs where the typist would go and the speechwriter would bark out commands, depending on which speechwriter. Sometimes they were polite, and dictate changes or make changes, or the Prime Minister himself would come in and talk to you over your shoulder while you were typing.
Mm. And did that actually happen to you?
Oh, yes, several times. Mm.
Well, thanks for that, Cheryl. In the previous session, we ended up where you had moved to work as secretary to the Department of Liaison person, I think.
Oh, yes, I changed roles. It was still in the Prime Minister's office, but the liaison officer was the second job that I had in the Prime Minister's office, working to the DLO. And in those days, there was one DLO. I think there's two or three or more now. And that was Peter Hand. And he was an excellent boss to work for, because he knew that I would be bored with just typing, so he gave me lots of little minor management roles to undertake, so that was good.
Mm. Yeah, I don't want to leap ahead too much, but is it a good time now to ask how you ended up in the press gallery? Do you want to?
Yeah, there is a kind of a link in a way. I left mid-year in 1980, I think, and took 6 months off, went jillarooing and all sorts of things. But I also knew that no secretarial job was ever going to be interesting again, and I needed to do something else. So I went back to school. I went to uni, which I'd not done before, and went back as a mature age student at 25 years of age. And after a couple of false starts, ended up doing journalism because I always loved writing. And in my final year of university, instead of looking around for secretarial jobs to get some extra cash, I thought I'll go door knocking in the Canberra Press Gallery. I knew where it was. The security wasn't around at the time, and the security guard still remembered me, the few who were there. So during the mid-year break, I thought, even if I get to type on a telex machine, which is those old machines they used, there were no computers in the old building at the time. They were moving up to the new building within a few years, so not many of the organisations actually introduced computers, even though they were used elsewhere. So I thought if I was there typing on a telex machine, at least I'd be where the action was. So I went door knocking in the press gallery, which is pretty scary when you're just a kid. But the second door I knocked on, David Kidd, bless him, he died about 10 years ago, I think, from the Weekly Times, said, "Well, I'm on leave next week, you can do my job." So my first job in the press gallery was the national political correspondent for the Weekly Times. And it was pretty scary at the time, but I managed to get the whole front page, which that's the old Orange comic, so the front cover was usually just a picture of some kind. The whole front page was lots of stories about things that were happening in Canberra. I didn't get a byline, but after that, the Orange comic came out the next week and it had my stories on the front page. I took those around to the Australian. It's amazing when you're young, you just have so much front. Took them around to the Australian, and Russell Schneider was the boss at the Australian at the time. And I said, I can do shorthand, and these are the stories I've done in my first week in journalism. And could I get a part-time job or fill in, or is there anything I can do here? And he said, "Well, come back next week and wear a dress." They were trying to be conservative in those days, so I had to go and buy one because I'd thrown them all away. And so I ended up then working at the Australian 2 or 3 days a week before I'd finished my journalism degree. And
you were doing the degree at ANU?
No, ANU didn't have one. I did it at the Canberra College of Advanced Education, which is Canberra Uni now. And also at 25, I think I couldn't get in as a mature age student at uni, at ANU, but I could at CAE. So that was the other reason I chose it.
Do you think your work in Fraser's office helped prepare you for political journalism?
I think it did, in the sense that I had an understanding, having had no education in politics and no discussions in the home. It actually gave me an understanding of about two houses of parliament, the negotiations to get legislation through parliament. The other thing that was unbelievably helpful was my shorthand. I could do shorthand verbatim while most journalists were relying on tape recorders. So I developed a system of two columns on my notepad, and when I had an exact quote, I put a little tick or a cross next to it. When it was a really important line, it was another little code. So if I had the exact quote, I could use the exact quote. If it wasn't the exact quote, I had enough information to know what they were saying and still write the story from that. So that saved me a lot of time in interviews. The only problem there was at a doorstop where you're standing up trying to take down notes was a little difficult. And the first doorstop I tried to do with the notepad and no tape recorder was a John Howard doorstop, and he never ever ever stuck to the script, and forever after that I borrowed someone's tape recorder because it was just too hard to keep up with somebody like John Howard.
Do you remember the type of tape recorders that were used back then?
I don't know what they were called, but the old old cassette recorders. Cassette, okay. The mini cassettes, I think, were starting to come in, but they were mainly the old cassette, yeah.
And how long were you with the Australian?
I did that for 6 months while I finished the degree, and at the end of the year I was negotiating with the Australian to get a cadetship, and then I was approached by AAP, Australian Associated Press, who offered me a D grade in journalism. Like none of it was very good money in those days, but as a new journalist you work for nothing just to get a job. And I weighed it up, the prestige of working for the Australian compared with working for AAP, doing a lot more work behind the scenes, which other journalists use to base their stories on or fill in their stories. I figured that at the ripe old age of 27, I really did need to learn about politics and reporting quickly. So I've just realised I must have left at 23 or 24 and started uni. But at the ripe old age of 27, I decided that I needed to learn quickly to catch up with all these older people who were there before me, and even a lot of younger people who were there before me, because they'd been in journalism from about 17. So I chose to work for the AAP on the basis that I would have to do a lot more work, and I would learn a lot more quickly, which was the right decision in the end.
And you were actually based in the press gallery?
Oh, yes. Yeah. In a little office. I don't know if they've finished the renovations yet, so you can see it, but the office was so tiny that when we had the extra troops in from Melbourne and Sydney when Parliament was sitting, there were so many people in the office. It was standing room only. There weren't enough seats to go around. There were only three phone lines in, and we had to brush past each other to walk around the office. It was so crowded. And OH&S wouldn't have applied there. And I suspect that the rules weren't as strict. It was a real fire hazard in those days. But it made for some interesting debates, general camaraderie in the end, but a lot of high tension when people are working on stories, trying to get them out. At AAP, there was an online, of course. It was the online equivalent of the day. So we would write a story competing with radio. So we would have to get back and put out a quick few lines for radio and then do our stories for newspapers.
And how would you get the copy to the...
Oh, they had computers. Very, very, very old-fashioned computers that generated a lot of RSI, which we don't hear of now. But there are a lot of people came down with RSI because of those computers. And it killed my eyesight, the black screen with the green letters on it. Was really, really bad for my eyesight, and it deteriorated like 20-fold while I was working there. But I didn't care. I had a job. I was at Parliament House. I was breaking stories. The nice thing about AAP, I had a real taste, although I did have a little bit of a taste at The Australian, at breaking stories, and that's what I loved about journalism, getting the story that they didn't want out. Right. And because it was AAP, you could put it on the wires very early, and so it would be running on radio, and radio would be following it. When we would break a story that was not a radio story, it was so big that you wanted to hold it for a newspaper, we would try to hold it until as late as possible in the evening. Because it was AAP and it went on the wires, quite often our breaking stories, the journalists would see it and then ring up a few sources, and then they would have the stories for themselves with their bylines. But if we held off long enough and got our timing right, we could get our own stories in the newspapers with our bylines.
Were there any journalists who had a particular impact on you, like mentoring in any way or sense?
I had a couple of mentors, and AAP was good for that. Mentoring wasn't really a strong focus in those days. It's certainly much more part of the workplace now. Having said that, one mentor, I guess, who became a very good friend, when at AAP, we would have to cover all of Parliament. So while all the journalists were in there for question time, we would have to have one person in the chamber, in each chamber, for the whole session. So we divided that up. I think in reps they might have had three or four people doing it. I ended up covering the Senate, and I found it fascinating learning about the legislative process and learned a lot about the Senate. That was really useful. But a lot of it was really tedious debate as well. But we would rotate, the three of us. We would have 30 minutes in the Senate and then an hour out of the Senate to write our stories while the other two were in there doing their 30 minutes. And Claire Arthurs was a young journo, a few years younger than me, who had a lot more experience because she'd been working for AAP for a couple of years by then. So she gave me the basics about never doing a story that you don't follow up. At least you write something the following day if there was a follow-up. At least if someone out there happened to be interested, they'd know that it was something came of it. And also, there was a sub-editor in Canberra who was brought to Canberra when Parliament was sitting, and a sub-editor in Sydney, so that all our stories were kind of turned into journalese by the time they went out, and they were turned around very quickly. And the computers you're able to have a split screen. So I would check every story of mine that went out to see what changes were made so that I would learn to write in journalese. I didn't learn a lot of that at university, which is a shame. So I learned a lot from following things up with people, and I always have had a tendency to ask a lot of questions. So there was a certain amount of guidance just because I would ask questions of people who'd been there a while. But that was, reporting the Senate was another occasion where the shorthand was unbelievably helpful. The other journalists would be running a tape. The proceedings would be broadcast into the office. And so people's tapes would be sitting on the speakers in the office while they were in the chamber taking notes. So they would have to come back and scroll through the tape to get their stories. And because I had shorthand, when I came back, I could write and I could type at 100 words a minute. So I could write my story and get it out in 10 minutes. That gave me 50 minutes before I was due back in the chamber to follow up any leads I had. And that was how I ended up breaking some stories along the way while I was working at AAP.
Is there a particular story you'd like to relate?
It's hard to remember. There are quite a few. And when they're lost in the mists of time, you realise that they weren't terribly relevant, but they were relevant for that 5 minutes of fame. One was the establishment of the centre-left faction of the ALP. I managed to get that story and run it when that was being debated. A few people had said, when I came back to the office and said, hey, I've got this story, a few people had heard about it but hadn't had it confirmed. So I got it confirmed and broke that story. Of course, the centre-left, I think it fell in, it reached its demise in the last few years. So it was a strong part of the Labor Party, and it was a reflection of the independents getting together as well and forming a bloc in the Labor Party. And another one, I used to get, and these were little stories. These days we hear a lot about people tweeting and sending text messages from the party meetings, particularly from caucus and the backbench meetings from the other side. I had one of the caucus members who used to phone me from the caucus room and give me a tip-off from what was happening in the caucus room. And one particular time it was an announcement that Neil Blewett was health minister he'd made in caucus. And I got this phone call. I don't know how this politician managed to find his way to the phone, but without being seen. But he'd given me this story, and because I could type quickly, at the by the time Minister Blewett had finished explaining this to the caucus, and as he was saying this should not be leaked to the media, their AAP screen of highlights was rolling behind him with his announcement. Apparently that was quite, I was quite chuffed when I found that out. As a journalist, you really do love breaking stories.
But did you find you had freedom as a journalist to get your basic information published?
Yeah. In the old Parliament House, well, getting it published, with AAP, it kind of went out into the ether, and we had some terrific people who'd scan all of the papers, and the regional papers took a lot of our work because they couldn't afford to have a journalist in Canberra. And so a lot of our work would appear with a byline in regional papers. And one of my favourites was the Geelong Advertiser, because they always gave us a byline. They were very good. And one of the nice things at AAP, you have your fair amount of egos in journalism, but at AAP in those days, when the clippings were sent up from Sydney, we always were congratulated when we got our bylines in the newspapers. Whereas for a journalist writing for a paper on a daily basis would get their byline in the paper all the time. At AAP, you earned it, and it was either a breaking story, or sometimes we did comment pieces which would be picked up by the regional papers, and it was, yeah, it was a nice thing to do. As for getting the stories, the old Parliament House, it was, you could feel a story if there was something brewing. You could feel it happening because it was so crowded. The little offices were shared by, I used to hang around the Senate offices a fair bit, and there was no foyer. There was only one room, tiny little room, with one and often two senators in it, with a staffer. And I don't even recall them having more than one staffer there at a time. There was just not room. So you could knock on the door, you'd go in and you'd see who they were talking to. Sometimes you'd even have a story just from that. A few times I actually knocked on a door and found another journalist in there, sort of chasing a story as well. Yeah, it was a lot easier to get stories in those days.
Shall we move on to your broadcast journalism? Is that appropriate?
Sure, yeah. After, I think it was 2.5 years or 2 years at AAP, I felt the need to experience something different. I decided to try for radio, and I ended up spending 3 months at the local ABC out in Northbourne Avenue. And that was okay. It was my first taste of proper journalism outside Parliament House, and I was pretty keen to get back to Parliament House. I did enjoy it for the experience, but once you've had a taste of politics, you want to get back there. But I managed to work out that when Parliament was sitting, the journalists and the politicians would be listening to local ABC news at 7:45 before the AM program. So if I had a breaking story, because I was always trying to do that, I'd save it up for the 8:45 AM news when Parliament was sitting. And I had a couple of stories, because I had some local contacts, about the bar at Old Parliament House, which was a fabulous place for getting stories, because everybody congregated around the bar at Old Parliament House. And you couldn't get to the phone there because there was an SP bookie using it. But I didn't even know. I was a kid. I hardly even knew what an SP bookie was, but I knew it was something that shouldn't be there. But I got in trouble when I tried to phone through a story from the bar one time because I was using up the one phone line. But I had this story, a couple of stories about the bar, where one of them was they'd closed it for fumigation on a Friday, but had left some of the beer glasses out. And so that would have been a bit of a health scare. total beat up, but I saved it for when the politicians came back to Canberra and the journalists were actually listening to it. And 3 months after I went to, I had a couple of stories like that. 3 months after I went to local ABC, I had a phone call from 2GB saying, did I want to come up to the Parliament House Bureau? And I was to be their number two reporter in a three-person bureau. The senior reporter was John Stanley, who now has his own program in Sydney. And the other guy was Michael Kavanagh, and then it was Steve Spencer. And they've both gone on and done other things. But I was the middle one. So the senior reporter did the big stories, the comment pieces, the Q&As, the talkback with the different programs around the place. The junior person did the little stories from the press releases. My job was go and find stories and break stories. Mm-hmm. So it was a combination of, I touched on the smaller stories, I touched on the bigger stories, and I was allowed to go around and talk to people, find out stuff and break stories. So I had lots of stories about, I had stories coming out of the shadow cabinet meetings. The Libs were in opposition then. I had a few of those, but that also set me up for when I was managing a political office, because one time I think it was some Liberals were crossing the floor on a particular policy issue. I can't even remember the issue, because as a journalist I was more interested in breaking the story than what the story was. I knocked on one of the senator's doors and said, oh, hey, I've got this story from Shadow Cabinet. Is it true? The senator wasn't there, but his offsider was, and the offsider said, oh, my gosh, that's the first time a story has been leaked out of Shadow Cabinet. And so that was my confirmation. So when I eventually was running an office, whoever was answering the phones was told, if a journalist asks you any question at all, you act completely stupid and say nothing, because they might be finding out something from you. Mm-hmm. And that worked most times. One time we did get caught out. It was quite funny. So I also managed, and it wasn't my doing, I have to say, the very first balanced budget that Paul Keating had, we broke that on air at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was under embargo. Journalists are in lockup until later that evening when the treasurer went into Parliament. But we managed to get that. The two guys were in the lockup. I was just outside trying to find stories, and still based at based in our office at Parliament House. And I had a phone call from one of the other lockups where there wasn't security, and they didn't want to shoot it back home to that other lockup. So I had to confirm it. The building was so small that you could run from one side to the other. The 2GB office was on the Senate side of the building. I ran over to the rep side of the building to try to check with the treasurer's staff, and found one of the treasurer's staff in the stairwell, yelled out down the stairwell, I've got this story, Tom. And I could tell. Sometimes you don't need a confirmation, yes or no. You just need the look on the face. And I saw that and I thought, I've got it. That was one of the exciting times in a small... one of the benefits of having such a tiny office, where the desk was one step from the booth. I had phoned through and said I had the story, and we had less than 5 minutes going to air to the news. We had a couple of minutes to the news. I can't remember how long. The guy who was putting the news together said, we will do an intro for you. You just make sure you've got your story ready. So we had these little portable typewriter things, and I was typing my story. And he said, listen to the news. When you hear Cheryl Cartwright reports, jump in, put the headphones on, start speaking. You're going live into the news. And as a news report, not as a talkback kind of thing. So I had to sound sensible. And I was very proud of myself for that one. I think I had one little in it, which they edited out, and they were able to use that report. But I was typing and I heard, and in Canberra, blah, 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 Cheryl Cartwright reports. In one step, I jumped from the chair into the booth, headphones on, push the switch, started speaking. You cannot get that kind of adrenaline outside politics. Mind you, I'm sure you can, but it's just one of those really amazingly exciting moments that stays with you. And obviously because of what the story was, the story stays with me, but there were quite a few moments like that. And especially with radio, if you're breaking a story, you want to get it to air as soon as possible to beat your other the other stations, because we had what was called Radio Alley. There was 2WS and 2UE, and also they broadcast out to other stations around the country as well, so it wasn't just the Sydney stations. So we were competing against those. You're competing against your colleagues.
Any anecdotes, further anecdotes about Radio Alley?
It was great camaraderie in Radio Alley. While we might be, because there were actually quite a few women there, but also while we were competing against each other, there wasn't a lot of bitchiness or aggression. It was quite friendly. It was friendly competition, which is interesting because in television, when competing in television, it was much bitchier if you beat someone to a story and they would try to discredit it. Whereas with this group, and I think that's just a personality thing, the people who happened to be there at the time, and the people who were there at the time were complimentary. You got a story, great one, we'll beat you with the next one, but you know, help us with the story where breaking the balance budget, they couldn't get it confirmed, and the other stations actually went to air with the story having me confirm it, which was a bit naughty on their part, but they were under pressure to go to air with something. And I said, it's genuine, it's true, it's a balanced budget. And what it ended up being was like a 10 million deficit or 10 million surplus or something like that. So it was qualified as a balanced budget. And one of the interesting things, I've got some friends who are a bit younger than me in the press gallery now. When I told them the story one time, they said, oh, did we used to have deficit budgets? You realise how old you are when that happens.
What was your relationship like with the politicians when you were in this building?
It was good, generally. It was very good. There were some politicians you were a little uncomfortable talking to. There was one in particular who, when you went to his little office, very small offices, you had to sit on a couch. And he was known for his attraction to... Sorry about that. This politician was known for his attraction
to... Cabinet incompetence begins in the cabinet.
Sorry for that.
It's all right, I'll start where I left. That particular politician, and I suspect I shouldn't name names because he's still alive, had a really bad reputation for his attraction to young female journalists. And even though I was in my 20s, I was pretty naive and very nervous. And I would feel incredibly compromised sitting on this couch in his office trying to interview him. And he never ever made a pass at me, I think possibly because I looked so terrified. So there was those kind of occasions. But generally, politicians and media at Parliament House get along reasonably well. It just needs to be managed properly. And as long as the journalist does the right thing by the politician and vice versa, they have a good working relationship where... I had been told, and I still now get told things that I shouldn't share, and you don't share them. And even as a journalist, I wouldn't break a faith if somebody had told me something in confidence. However, you can use that information to inform your judgment on a story. And that's a subtlety that is sometimes not understood. And that exists now. But when that breaks down and when that's not understood, that's where the relationships between politicians and journalists break down.
I can imagine, though, that you would inevitably end up writing a report that a politician wasn't happy with, like it wasn't in their what they were hoping to convey.
That didn't happen to me in Canberra. The politicians in Canberra were a little more switched on than state. I did state politics for a little while after this job. I didn't need to break a confidence, no. I didn't break a confidence, but yes, I did upset John Howard one time and he never forgave me. But what I'd said was actually fair, but because of my style, I tend to be very direct. And so mine was the first report about the poor handling of question time one time. Now, that wasn't a report, that was a Q&A. The senior journalist in 2GB at the time, he must have been off away doing something else. So I was doing the Q&A and I was talking about how the opposition hadn't made the most of question time at that time. John Howard was leader. And I was probably a little more harsh than I needed to be. And John Howard rang the station immediately after that and accused me of being biased and unfair and a lackey of the Labor Party. And did eventually have a very strong understanding of media. I think he was still learning it in those days, as I was still learning to develop my contacts in those days. I didn't have strong contacts